So imagine having like $10 million sitting in your bank account, right? But your doctor just sat you down and explained that the chronic stress of actually earning all that money has essentially taken 10 years off your life.
Wow. Yeah, that's heavy.
Right. Or, you have this ultimate high status job, but you haven't had a single conversation with your spouse in, gosh, like 6 months that didn't completely revolve around scheduling or logistics.
Just running the machine, basically.
Exactly, just logistics. You own three properties, but you honestly can't remember the last time you woke up feeling rested, let alone, actually peaceful. So the question for you is, are you wealthy or are you just rich?
I mean, that right there, that is the ultimate diagnostic trap, isn't it? When it comes to measuring a good life, we get so caught up.
We really do.
We look at the visible markers of success, the quantifiable data, and we just assume that because the numbers are so large, the structural integrity of that person's life must be completely sound.
Yeah, like big number equals good life.
Right. But those two things, they're operating on entirely different axes. They really are.
They absolutely are. And welcome everyone to today's custom tailored deep dive. We are just thrilled you're joining us today because our mission here is fundamentally different from the way we, well, usually approach our analysis.
Oh, very different.
Normally, we're parsing through massive stacks of data for you. We look at like longitudinal studies, we break down these thick academic chapters, sift through historical texts, and we try to extract the vital signals from all that noise.
Yeah, finding the needle in the haystack.
Exactly. But today, however, there is almost no noise to filter. Our entire stack of source material today consists of a single, highly provocative fragment.
Which is so rare for us, it forces a completely different type of analytical rigor.
It really does.
When you're deprived of hundreds of pages of exposition and, all the supporting arguments, you have to interrogate the words themselves.
Yes, the words have to do all the heavy lifting. And the source material we've been given today is literally an eight-word title. That is it, just eight words.
It's amazing.
The text reads, "The difference between being rich and being wealthy." And our mission today is to deeply analyze the premise of this title, what it demands of you as the reader, and the profound, just cascading implications of these eight
This
words.
is a lot packed into a little space.
It is. I genuinely love this kind of philosophical prompt, though. Sometimes the absolute shortest texts force the deepest thinking because, well, there's nowhere for the author or the reader, honestly, to hide.
No fluff, just the raw concept.
Right. So, okay, let's unpack this right now because right out of the gate, we are confronted with a really hard dichotomy.
We are. And what's fascinating here is that the author completely assumes the reader might currently be confusing the two
Oh,
concepts.
that's a great point.
By explicitly announcing that there is a difference, the text implies that society largely treats these two things as identical. I mean, this isn't just an introduction to a concept, it's an intervention.
An intervention. I like that.
Yeah, it's setting up an immediate paradigm shift for you before you even read a hypothetical first chapter.
It really hinges on that one word, doesn't it? Difference.
Absolutely.
Because the author isn't suggesting like a spectrum or a Venn diagram where the two concepts sort of overlap in the middle. The use of the difference establishes a really definitive boundary line.
And that boundary line is incredibly disruptive because in our everyday vernacular, we use the terms interchangeably all the
Oh,
time.
constantly.
If we see someone drive by in a $250,000 sports car, we say, wow, they must be rich.
Right.
If we see an enormous estate on a cliffside, we say, oh, that's a wealthy family. We use both terms to describe the exact same observation, which is basically the presence of abundant, visible financial resources.
Yeah, the visible stuff.
But this text, it just throws up a stop sign. It absolutely demands that we decouple these two words.
I do want to push back on this just a little bit, though, because I think we need to ground this in reality for a second.
Sure, let's do it.
Are we just splitting hairs over dictionary definitions here? I mean, if I literally go look up rich in a thesaurus right now, the very first synonym is going to be wealthy.
That's true. It will be.
Right. So let's play devil's advocate for the listener who is, grinding out 80-hour weeks right now.
Okay.
If someone is drowning in medical debt, or they literally can't afford their rent this month, they do not care about the philosophical nuances of wealth.
No, they don't. They're in survival mode.
Exactly. They need the brute force of being rich just to solve an immediate existential crisis. So isn't being rich essentially the necessary first stage of like a rocket launch?
A rocket launch. Okay. I like where you're going with this.
Yeah, like you need that massive, just explosive thrust of capital just to get off the ground, right? Making rich a total prerequisite for wealth.
The rocket launch analogy is highly applicable, actually. But let's follow the physics of it all the way through.
Okay, let's do it.
The booster rocket of being rich, you know, that aggressive accumulation of capital, the high income, the relentless hustle, it is absolutely necessary to break free from the gravitational pull of financial insecurity.
Right. Gravity is a beast. You need that power.
You do. And I really don't think this text is arguing that capital is unnecessary. That's not the point. The danger and the difference the text points to is what happens when that booster rocket fails to detach.
Oh, wow. That is a really interesting mechanical failure to consider.
Right.
If it doesn't detach, it just drags the payload entirely off course.
Precisely. If you reach orbit, but you keep firing that booster rocket of aggressive accumulation, you eventually just tear the ship apart.
Yeah, the G-force would destroy it.
Society trains us to engineer the booster rocket perfectly, but it provides zero instruction manual on how to detach it, like none at all.
We are conditioned to believe that, you know, if $1 million provides a certain amount of security, then 10 million will provide 10 times that security.
Exactly. But the correlation completely breaks down at a certain point. The pursuit of being rich, when it doesn't transition into the architecture of being wealthy, it actually becomes destructive.
So the functional distinction is really about knowing what phase of the mission you are in.
Yeah.
It's like the difference between knowing all the words to a song versus actually understanding how the music is composed.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it. Elaborate on the mechanics of that for the listener.
Well, okay, so if you are rich in this analogy, you have the lyrics memorized, you know them perfectly.
Right.
You can sing the song really loudly at karaoke, you get every single beat, and you have successfully acquired the raw data of the song. It is visible, it's performative, and literally everyone in the room can see that you possess it.
The external broadcast.
Right. You have the external markers of success. But being wealthy is understanding the music theory behind the song.
Oh, so
you understand why a minor chord evokes a specific emotional response. You appreciate the silence between the notes just as much as the notes themselves.
The silence is key.
Yeah. And you possess the foundational knowledge to write your own song if you wanted to. So one is a surface-level metric of acquisition and performance, right? While the other is a deeper structural reality of understanding and actual freedom.
The music theory comparison holds up beautifully, I think, because it really highlights the transition from external validation to internal mastery.
Internal mastery.
Rich is just heavily associated with the external broadcast. High income, luxury goods, visible consumption. It's loudly broadcasting the lyrics to an audience.
Look at me singing.
Exactly. But wealth is often completely silent. It's the structural reality underneath the performance. It is having assets that generate income while you sleep. Yes. But it's also, you know, having the psychological freedom to decline an invitation to perform in the first place.
Okay. Let's linger on that word perform for a second.
Yeah.
Because if being rich is a performance, it inherently demands an audience.
It absolutely does.
You can't really be rich in a vacuum. Like, if you buy the $250,000 sports car, but you live on a completely deserted island where no one can ever see you drive it, the richness kind of loses its primary utility.
Completely.
The value of the object is largely tied to the status it projects to others.
Which means your state of being is entirely dependent on the perception of observers.
Oh, that sounds exhausting.
It is. If your identity relies on constant external validation, you know, the newest trends, the highest status symbols, the constant flow of incoming cash just to maintain the visible outgoing lifestyle, you are trapped in a feedback loop.
Yeah, a really stressful one.
You are essentially working for the audience, not for yourself.
But wait, what if the audience is demanding the lyrics? Let's take the high achiever executive again.
Okay.
Say they are a partner at a massive law firm. The firm demands that they wear the bespoke suit, they have to drive the luxury car, and they must live in the right zip code because that visible richness signals competence to their very wealthy clients.
That's a real scenario, yes.
Right. They are structurally required to perform richness just to maintain their income.
And that is the exact trap that eight words are warning us about.
The trap of the performance.
Yes. When the performance of richness becomes a structural requirement for survival, the individual's well-being is heavily compromised. They are rich, sure, but they have zero autonomy.
None.
They cannot easily walk away. Their time is dictated by the firm. Their geographical location is dictated by the firm. Even their aesthetic choices are dictated by the firm.
That's true, down to the watch they wear.
Right. They have immense financial resources, but they completely lack the negative space.
The negative space? Wait, break that down.
So in art and design, the negative space is the empty space around and between the subjects of an image.
Okay, like the background.
Yeah, but it's more than just background. It is what actually gives the subject its shape and its structural integrity. And in the context of a human life, wealth is the negative space.
Oh.
It is the absence of debt-induced panic. It's the absence of a toxic boss dictating your schedule. It is the absence of a chronically elevated heart rate.
That is so powerful.
You can easily photograph the subject, you know, the yacht, the designer clothes, all the visible richness. But you cannot easily photograph an absence.
No, you can't.
You cannot take a picture of a peaceful Tuesday morning where you have absolutely nothing urgent to do and zero underlying anxiety.
You cannot photograph an absence. That is such a critical insight for anyone navigating modern life right now.
It's the core problem with how we view success.
It really is, because everything around us, specifically the digital landscape, social media, all of it, is entirely built on photographing presence.
Exactly. Showing the stuff.
Right. Our entire culture over-indexes on the visual presence of richness because it translates so well through a screen. It generates engagement, likes, comments, shares.
It's highly optimized for the algorithm.
Totally. We are bombarded with millions of data points every single day showing us what being rich looks like. Mm-hmm. But we have almost zero cultural data points showing us what being wealthy feels like because, as you said, it's invisible.
Which leads directly to profound cognitive dissonance.
Oh, for sure.
People achieve all the visible markers. They buy the big house. They get the fancy title. They acquire all the presents. But internally, they feel completely chaotic and trapped.
Because they lack the negative space.
Yes. They lack the negative space. They lack the structural wealth. They're experiencing the exact gap highlighted by our source text. But because society has totally conflated the two words, they don't even possess the vocabulary to diagnose their own misery.
That's heartbreaking, actually.
They assume that if they feel terrible, well, they must just need more richness.
It's a massive misdiagnosis of the symptoms. They think, I'm stressed, so I must need a bigger boat to relax on, which of course requires taking on more debt, which only increases the stress.
A completely vicious cycle.
It really is. And this brings us right to the heart of the grammar in the source text, which we have to talk about.
The grammar is everything here.
It is. Because the author doesn't just say rich versus wealthy. The author inserts a very specific, deliberate word twice. The difference between being rich and being wealthy.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the linguistic choice of the word being is really the key that unlocks the deepest layer of this text.
I agree.
It elevates the entire topic from a mere, like, financial how-to guide to a profound question of personal identity and ontology.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. Let's do a close reading of that word.
Let's do it.
The text deliberately uses the present participle.
Yeah.
It doesn't say the difference between getting rich and getting wealthy.
Right. Getting would imply a process of acquisition.
Exactly.
It would read like a tactical manual on how to accumulate resources. It would focus purely on the mechanics of the transaction. Step one, step two.
Right. And it also doesn't say the difference between having riches and having wealth either. I want to really dig into the difference between having and being, because that feels like the real fault line of the whole prompt.
That's a huge distinction.
Having suggests external possession, like I have a coat, I have a car, I have a pile of money in the bank. These are objects separate from my core self.
They are detachments.
Yeah. If I lose the coat, I am still me. I am just a cold version of me. But being is ontological. It is about your existence, your state of nature, your core identity.
When you adopt the state of being, it is no longer a tool that you just pick up and put down. It is the lens through which you view every single interaction.
It filters everything.
Yes. When you say, I am rich, you are adopting it as an identity. It dictates how you walk into a room, how you treat a waiter, how you calculate your own social worth, and, crucially, how you perceive threats.
Okay, let's explore that threat perception aspect. Mm-hmm. Because if your identity is, I am rich, and your richness is defined by high income and visible status, then an economic downturn isn't just a financial problem.
No, not at all.
It is a massive existential threat. If you lose the money, you don't just lose your possessions, you lose your being. You essentially cease to exist in your current form. That level of fragility has to be completely devastating to the human nervous system.
It creates a state of chronic hypervigilance.
Constantly looking over your shoulder.
Exactly. The nervous system actually cannot distinguish between a threat to your physical survival and a threat to your core identity.
Wait, really? The nervous system treats them the same.
It treats them identically. If your identity requires constant visible capital outlays just to maintain it, you are perpetually on the defensive. You are guarding the perimeter of your identity 24/7.
That sounds like a nightmare.
That is not wealth. That is a highly decorated prison.
So if being rich often devolves into this fragile, hypervigilant state, how does the nervous system process being wealthy?
It's totally different.
Like, if wealth is defined by structural well-being, time autonomy, and, you know, the negative space of stress, what does that state of being actually feel like inside the body?
It feels like groundedness.
Groundedness.
Yeah. It is the physiological shift from fight or flight to rest and digest. When you are wealthy, your identity is not tied to a fluctuating external metric. Your security is intrinsic.
It comes from within.
Exactly. You might still participate in the economy. You might still build businesses or invest, but you are not doing it to maintain a fragile persona. You're doing it from a foundation of absolute security. The threats are just no longer existential.
Is that internal security only possible after you have acquired the massive pile of money?
Oh.
I want to make sure we aren't, you know, romanticizing the concept of wealth to the point where it sounds like a purely spiritual exercise.
It's a fair concern.
Because we live in a physical world that requires capital. You cannot pay your grocery bill with groundedness.
A critical distinction, absolutely. The text doesn't claim money is irrelevant, right? It demands we recognize the difference in how we relate to it.
Right.
Wealth still requires resources, but the resources are deployed entirely differently. Let's look at the logistics of being wealthy versus being rich at the exact same income level.
Oh, this is a great exercise.
Let's take two people who both make $300,000 a year. They have the exact same influx of capital.
Okay, let's track the capital. Person A wants to be rich. Person B wants to be wealthy. How do their logistics diverge?
So person A, chasing the state of being rich, uses that $300,000 to maximize their visible footprint.
The performance.
Exactly. They take out a massive mortgage on a highly visible property in the best neighborhood. They lease two luxury vehicles. They send their children to the most expensive, status-driven private schools.
Maxing out the lyrics of the song.
Yes. And at the end of the year, their capital has been entirely converted into presence, into performance. They have zero liquid reserves, incredibly high debt obligations, and they must earn exactly $300,000 again next year just to keep the whole structure from collapsing.
So person A's nervous system is fully redlined.
Completely maxed out.
If they lose their job, the entire identity shatters in like 30 days. They are incredibly rich, visibly, but entirely devoid of wealth.
Exactly.
What about person B?
Person B, who is chasing the state of being wealthy, uses the exact same $300,000 to maximize their negative space.
Okay, so buying the absence of stress.
Right. They buy a modest home that costs half of what they were actually approved for, minimizing their debt. They drive reliable, paid-off cars. They heavily fund investment accounts that generate invisible passive returns.
Boring, but effective.
Exactly. To the observer on the street, person B looks aggressively average, but internally. Person B knows that if they lose their job tomorrow, they can survive for 5 years without even changing their lifestyle.
Wow. The power dynamic is completely inverted.
It really is.
Person A is a hostage to their income. Person B is the master of their time. And this brings us back to that concept of the booster rocket from earlier.
The physics of the launch.
Right. Person B used the rocket, the high income, to achieve an orbit of autonomy. They detached it. Person A just strapped the rocket to their back and is flying around in the atmosphere at Mach 3, completely terrified of running out of fuel.
The irony here, though, is that society will consistently praise person A and basically ignore person B.
Oh, totally. Society loves person A.
We will give person A the better table at the restaurant. We will assume person A is the more successful individual. And because of that societal reinforcement, it requires immense psychological fortitude for person B to just stay on their path.
That is the hidden friction in this 8-word prompt.
It's the hardest part.
The difference between being rich and being wealthy implies a choice. It implies that you have to actively select which state of being you want to inhabit. But choosing to be wealthy in a culture that exclusively rewards being rich is practically an act of rebellion.
It is a total rebellion.
You have to be deeply comfortable with being misunderstood.
Mm.
You have to be okay with your neighbors thinking you are less successful than you actually are.
It requires decoupling your self-worth from external observation. If you require the audience to validate your success, you will always default to the path of being rich.
You'll always buy the fancy car.
You will. You will always prioritize the visible over the structural. The text demands that you look inward and ask,
yeah.
Am I building a life for my own experience, or am I building a museum for other people to walk through?
Am I building a life for my own experience or a museum for other people to walk through? That is just phenomenal.
It reframes the whole goal.
It does. Because a museum is curated. It is sterile. It is designed entirely for the gaze of the visitor. You don't actually live in the exhibits. You just maintain them.
And maintaining a museum is exhausting work.
It really is. It also makes me think about how this dichotomy applies laterally, like completely outside the realm of personal finance.
Oh, it maps onto almost everything.
It really does. If richness is the visible accumulation and wealth is the structural well-being in negative space, we can map this onto almost any human pursuit. Think about knowledge and information, for instance.
Let's test the parameters of the logic. How does it apply to knowledge?
Okay, well, you could be knowledge rich.
Yeah.
We all know people exactly like this.
Oh, definitely.
They consume endless streams of content.
Yeah.
They listen to 100 deep dives on 2x speed. They read a book a week. They've acquired massive volumes of data points, and they can deploy those facts at a dinner party to appear incredibly smart.
The human encyclopedia.
Right. They have the visible accumulation of information,
yeah.
But internally, they're completely frantic. They can't sit in silence. They don't actually apply any of the knowledge to improve their own lives. They just warehouse it.
They are performing intelligence, much like person A performs financial success.
Exactly. But being knowledge wealthy would imply wisdom. It's the negative space of information. It's not about how many books you've read. It's about having the mental clarity to synthesize a few profound truths and actually embody them.
Less noise, more structure.
The knowledge wealthy person isn't shouting facts at the dinner party. They're the ones asking the quiet, penetrating questions. They possess the structural integrity of understanding rather than the loud volume of data.
The lateral application works perfectly with relationships as well.
Oh, I'd love to hear how that maps out.
You can be relationship rich, which in the modern era translates to, you know, thousands of followers, a packed social calendar, and a phone that absolutely never stops buzzing.
Right. The influencer lifestyle.
Exactly. You have acquired a vast quantity of weak tie connections. The visible metrics of your social life are off the charts.
But the maintenance of that network, I mean, the constant texting, the curation of the online persona, the anxiety of missing an event and losing relevance.
It's exhausting.
The nervous system is, again, in a state of complete hypervigilance.
Contrast that with being relationship wealthy. This individual might only have 3 or 4 deep connections. Their social calendar is mostly empty. Their phone rarely rings.
They look socially poor to the outside observer.
Exactly. To the outside observer, they might appear isolated or unpopular. But those 3 connections are load-bearing walls.
Load-bearing walls. I love that.
They are the people who will sit with you in a hospital room at 3 non-AM without needing an explanation. The relationship wealthy person has maximized the negative space. They have eliminated the social noise and the transactional obligations, leaving only the profound structural ties.
I just love how the 8 words of this text serve as a skeleton key.
It really unlocks everything.
It does. Once you understand the difference between the accumulation of the visible, the rich, and the structural integrity of the invisible, the wealthy, you start seeing the dichotomy everywhere. You see it in how companies are built. You see it in how people exercise. You see it in how people travel.
Take travel as an example.
Okay, the rich traveler is trying to hit 7 European cities in 10 days.
The classic whirlwind tour.
Right. They are accumulating stamps on the passport. They are acquiring photos in front of all the major landmarks. It is an aggressive acquisition of geography to broadcast to the audience back home. Look at everywhere I went.
It's an itinerary built for Instagram.
Exactly. But they spend the entire trip completely stressed about train schedules, packing, and making the dinner reservations.
And the wealthy traveler?
The wealthy traveler goes to one small village. They rent a house for 2 weeks. They do almost nothing visible.
Sounds amazing.
Right. They walk to the same bakery every morning. They read a book on the porch. They acquire 0 status photos. But they return home structurally rested. Their nervous system has reset. They optimized for the internal experience, not the external broadcast.
What you were describing across all these domains, finance, knowledge, relationships, travel, is a fundamental shift in the definition of a primary resource.
A primary resource.
Yes. The culture of being rich insists that the ultimate resource is capital or data or social status.
The quantifiable stuff.
Right. But the culture of being wealthy recognizes that the ultimate non-renewable resource is time and human attention.
Yes. Let's drill down into time and attention, because I really think that is the ultimate battlefield where the war between rich and wealthy is fought.
It is the core of it all.
You can always make another dollar. You can always buy another car. You cannot buy back the decade you spent stressing over the mortgage you couldn't afford.
Time is the ultimate metric of wealth. If we go back to our premise that wealth is the negative space, time is the canvas itself.
The canvas itself.
When you are optimizing for being rich, you are almost always trading your time for capital. You are literally selling your life energy to fund the performance.
It's a heavy trade.
But when you optimize for being wealthy, you use whatever capital you have to buy back your time. You recognize that having agency over your Tuesday afternoon is fundamentally more valuable than the prestige of your job title.
I want to talk about the friction of making that pivot, though. Let's talk directly to you, the listener.
Yeah, let's bring it back to the individual.
If you are sitting in traffic right now, commuting to a high-paying job that leaves you utterly drained, and you are realizing that you have been successfully mastering the art of getting rich while failing spectacularly at being wealthy, What do you do with that realization?
It's a tough pill to swallow.
Because you can't just flip a switch and instantly change your state of being. The architecture of your life is already built around the rich paradigm.
The dismantling of the rich architecture is arguably more difficult than building it in the first place because it requires ego death.
Ego death. That is a really heavy term. Break that down in this context.
Well, we established that being rich is an identity heavily reliant on external validation. Your ego, your sense of self-worth, has intertwined itself with your job title, your neighborhood, and your visible consumption.
It's who you think you are.
Right. If you decide to pivot toward wealth, you have to actively dismantle the very things that society uses to validate you.
Oh, that's terrifying.
You might have to downsize the house. You might have to step off the partner track to take a role with less prestige but more autonomy. You are consciously choosing to look less successful to the untrained eye. Your ego will absolutely scream at you, and your peers might genuinely question your ambition.
You will have people actively telling you that you are making a massive mistake. Why are you stepping down? You are on track for the C-suite.
They'll think you're crazy.
But they are measuring you with the wrong ruler. They're using the rich ruler to measure a wealthy blueprint.
Exactly. And navigating that requires a profound internal anchor. This is why the word being is so essential in the text.
It really is the anchor.
You cannot fake your way through that transition. You cannot intellectualize it. You must fundamentally alter your state of being. You must find your security in the invisible structural realities of your life, your health, your time, your deep relationships, rather than the visible markers.
It's the transition from playing the finite game to the infinite game.
Oh, I like that framing.
Yeah, like being rich is a finite game. It's comparative. You are rich relative to your neighbors. There is a clear scoreboard.
Win or lose.
Right. But being wealthy is an infinite game. The goal isn't to beat anyone else. The goal is simply to keep playing the game of life with as much joy, health, and autonomy as possible.
And that transition from the finite to the infinite game is precisely what this 8-word text demands of the reader. It acts as a catalyst.
Which really brings us to the most brilliant part of our source material today, the sheer brevity of it. We don't have the rest of the text.
No, we don't.
We don't have the author's 10-point plan for achieving wealth. We don't have the step-by-step instructions on how to downsize your ego. We only have the title. We only have the premise.
The absence of the subsequent text acts as a mirror, a psychological projection test.
Because the rest of the text is missing, you, the listener, are forced to become the author. When you hear the prompt, the difference between being rich and being wealthy, your brain immediately tries to solve the puzzle.
It can't help it.
You start categorizing your own life. You look at your savings account, your stress levels, your calendar, your physical health, and you ask yourself, wait, which one am I chasing?
If we had a 500-page book in front of us, we could passively consume the author's arguments. We could sit back and intellectually critique their specific definitions of wealth. We could treat it as a purely academic exercise.
We just critique their framework.
Exactly. But by only providing the assertion that there is a difference and that it is tied to our being, the text removes our ability to be passive. It lodges a splinter in the mind. It demands that you define the terms for your own life.
It makes you realize that you might have been running a marathon at a sprint pace without ever actually checking the map to see if you were heading toward the right finish line.
And once you possess the vocabulary to articulate the difference between the two finish lines, you can never unsee it.
No, it's a permanent shift.
You will start noticing it in your own decisions, in the behavior of your colleagues, in the underlying structure of every advertisement you see. You will realize that almost every external force is trying to sell you the state of being rich, usually by promising that it will eventually lead to being wealthy.
But as we've established today, the mechanics of the two states are often fundamentally opposed.
They are. You cannot buy your way into the negative space. You have to carve it out. You have to remove the noise.
You have to carve it out.
Yeah.
Let's pull all these threads together. We started today with an incredibly sparse piece of source material, just a fragment of a thought. The difference between being rich and being wealthy.
Just 8 words.
And from those 8 words, we have excavated a massive structural divide in how humans pursue a good life. We've looked at how the boundary of difference exposes the flaw in our everyday vocabulary.
The conflation of the two.
We debated the pragmatic reality of needing capital, but realized the fatal error is strapping the booster rocket to your back and never detaching it. We explored how richness is an external loud performance that requires an audience, while wealth is the internal silent structural integrity of the negative space.
We also dissected the ontological weight of the word being, analyzing how the nervous system reacts to a fragile identity built on visible consumption versus a secure identity built on autonomy and well-being.
The hypervigilance versus the groundedness.
Exactly. And we track the logistics of the two paths, realizing that the transition from rich to wealthy requires the ego death of looking less successful to the outside world.
So what does this all mean? It means that this brief fragment is arguably more powerful than a 1,000-page textbook. It forces you to build your own compass before you take another step in your career, your finances, or your personal life. It demands that you audit the actual architecture of your own existence.
This raises an important question, one that expands well beyond the immediate definitions we've debated today.
Okay, lay it on us.
If the society we live in has engineered nearly every incentive structure, every status marker, and every algorithm to reward the pursuit of being rich, and if our analysis suggests that being wealthy requires a completely different, often invisible set of mechanics, what if the most radical, transformative act you can undertake isn't acquiring more resources?
What if it's not about adding more?
Right. What if the true revolution begins simply by redefining the vocabulary you allow to govern your decisions?
The vocabulary that governs your decisions. Ow. At the very beginning of our deep dive today, we talked about that bank account app, the precision of the digits on the screen, the comfort of that binary measurement.
It's very seductive.
It is. But if you walk away from today's conversation with anything, let it be this realization. The screen can only ever measure how rich you are. It tracks the accumulation of the visible. It will never, ever be able to measure how wealthy you are.
Because the wealth happens off screen.
That measurement happens completely off screen. It happens in the quiet moments of your Tuesday afternoon, in the steady rhythm of your resting heart rate, and in the profound peace of your own being. So the question remains, which word do you truly want defining the architecture of your life?
A powerful question to sit with.
It really is. Thank you so much for exploring this fascinating and vivable landscape with us today. Keep defining your own terms, audit your negative space, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.